Welcome to Tales of Northern Michigan's Past. I'm your host, Christopher Struble. In 2021, the village of Walloon unveiled a statue in honor of the Nobel and Pulitzer Award-winning author Ernest Hemingway, who spent the better part of his first 23 summers of life with his family on Walloon Lake. Since 2021, the village has sponsored several events, including their annual writer's retreat. This year, the featured author for the event was Valerie Hemingway, author of Running with the Bulls, My Time with the Hemingways. Valerie was Ernest's secretary, friend, confidant, and later, after his death, she married his youngest son, Gregory, hence the last name. As president of the Michigan Hemingway Society, I was invited to moderate a lakeside chat with Valerie 2 weeks ago during the Walloon Writers Retreat. And even after having spent so much time together over the years since we met, there are always new stories that she shares, as the Hemingway scholar are just priceless and often very entertaining. Today we are fortunate to have as our guest for the first episode of Season 4 of Tales of Northern Michigan's Past, my dear friend, Valerie Hemingway. Welcome, Valerie.
Thank you, Chris. Delighted to be here.
Well, we're a bit farther apart than the last time. We're at mere feet, and you are now in Bozeman, Montana. Is that correct?
Yes, 2,000 miles away from you, practically.
Well, things are looking a little bit more like Hemingway remembered them, as spring is teasing us a little bit. Our walking tour 2 weeks ago, it was a bit brutal, wasn't it?
It was, but since I live in Montana, that's not unknown to me.
Well, those were the torrents of spring. That's the season that he refers to in that book. So you never know what you're going to get up here in April and early May.
It's beautiful.
Yeah, this is the best time of the year. This morning I was taking the dog for a walk, and I looked out over the bay. We had crazy mist floating across between Petoskey and Harbor Springs. Just spectacular. I often like the joke, too. The first time we met, this is my claim to fame, is Edward, your son, and I. Edward's an amazing illustrator and an author himself. We stayed out a little too late, and the next morning you kind of scolded me for staying out. You said, "You're the one, huh, who kept my son out so late last night." So I had the distinction of being scolded for keeping a Hemingway out, drinking a little too late in the evening after the hours by a Hemingway. So that's my claim to fame.
Well, that was good that I had an excuse for Edward being out late.
It's interesting to me, and I forgot, I guess I didn't notice, there was so many of these people from the forums that night that Diana Stampler, who hosted the event for the Hotel Walloon and organized everything, and she does such a great job. But she and I are on all these sites with Hemingway scholars, and there's always new books coming out, new perspectives and everything. But it's always interesting to me that they sit here and debate all these little facts, you know, about what his favorite mustard was, or none of these people met him. They're all going off either letters or somebody else's version. So it just kind of keeps being kind of, I hate to use the word regurgitated, but I don't know anything better. So that's the fun thing when we're speaking with you, is all these stories, these are all firsthand accounts. I mean, you spent so much time with him and in such different capacities also.
Well, yes. Well, I would say that there's no substitute for actually knowing Hemingway. I mean, he was such a vivacious person and so interested in everything and interested particularly in people, that I've never really duplicated that experience with anyone else. I was lucky to know him towards the end of his life, so I probably had the very best of what Hemingway, I had the whole value of his learning and, and his personality and so on. I mean, people so often misread and say, "Oh, Hemingway was, he was finished, you know, by the 1950s, that was the end of him." But I can tell you that I have never met anyone who had as much interest in life and in enjoying life and sharing that enjoyment as I had with him in those days.
Well, truly a special experience for sure. And those are things that people don't talk about so much about Hemingway. So many things that were put out in the documentary, the Ken Burns documentary. And I think that was just a very unfair portrayal of the real Hemingway. And again, you know, these are people just kind of talking about anecdotes that they've heard over the years. But it seemed that Ken kind of had a hatchet to grind or something. When you speak of Hemingway, you speak again of somebody who had a zest for life, who loved to share, who loved to interest other people. And I think the best thing you said was when he gave you something to read, he wanted your perspective on that. You said, you know, he didn't want somebody coming up to him and saying, well, what does this mean and for whom the bell tolls? You said, what does it mean to you? So he wanted you to think and to learn for yourself.
That's right, because even with his own works, he would say to people who came up to him, I actually witnessed this when they said, Mr. Hemingway, what did you mean when you wrote such and such in, say, A Farewell to Arms or For Whom the Bell Tolls? And he would say, well, I know exactly what I meant because that was from my experience. And when you read it, it's only going to mean what you can bring it from your experience. You know, and that to me was a great lesson that we have to have. Well, by reading we learn, because one of the things he said to me, if you want to be a writer, the first thing you do is read all the great books, and he followed that up with giving me a handful of books. We were out at the Fink at that time when I was in, that was in his home in Cuba, and I was working as his secretary that year in 1960. And he felt that apart from work, which wasn't too arduous, that one's leisure time should be filled with learning things. So he taught me a lot of things, because he was not a person who said something without demonstrating what he meant by it.
And again, now these are the later years. He's 59 years old at this time when you meet him?
He's 59 he turned 60 in 1959. So that he was 60 when I was there in Cuba. But when I first knew him, he was 59, and that was in Spain.
You're a journalist at this time. Did you always want to be a writer also?
Oh, absolutely. Well, I was interested in journalism. I never thought that perhaps I would be a novelist. I mean, that was, for me, a novelist was something rather awesome and required, a lot more experience and talent in writing. Hemingway referred to his writing as his genre, his métier, his trade. And he put a lot of emphasis on that writing was something that you cultivated. It wasn't something that you inherited or by some grace or power of the gods, you suddenly were a writer. You were a writer by hard work and hard, repetitive work. And journalism was a great way of using this or learning this talent. And not that I knew Hemingway when I was growing up, you know, until I was 19, but I wanted to write. I mean, writing was one of the main elements of our education. Without that, reading and writing was the center of one's education in Ireland at the time. And then, of course, there were the sciences and the mathematics, which were adjunct and were equally interesting. But in those days, girls were taught to gear towards reading and writing rather than science and math, and that was fine with me. I mean, I enjoyed in my senior school years the math and science, but already I knew that what I really wanted to do was write, and it seemed to me, since I didn't have a chance to go to university, that journalism would be the way I could create a career for myself writing. And I'd done a little bit in Ireland before I left and went to Spain. But when I went to Spain, it was with the idea that I would do some freelance writing for the Irish Times. But it wasn't in that capacity that I met Hemingway. It was I attached myself, or I was lucky enough to be asked to do interviews, English language interviews for a Belgian news service. And it was they who sent me to interview Hemingway.
I love the story. The first, how'd the first question go?
Well, that was a disaster. I mean, funnily enough, I'd done three or four interviews before the Hemingway one, and they had nothing to do with writers or writing. But I was given a list of questions, and the questions all pertained to the matter at hand, and so I was very successful. And then I came to Hemingway's the interview, which I felt much more at ease doing, thinking I'd read a lot of books, and I'd read two books of Hemingway's, a book of short stories, and whatever the one was that came out in the it might have been Men Without Women, whatever came out in the 1920s. And I'd read The Sun Also Rises, which actually was banned in Ireland. And I had found it with the help of my friend on her uncle's bedside table. He was on the censorship board, and the censorship board divided among them the books that were not allowed to be sold that were banned. And each of us, my friend Delphine, we each borrowed a book. The one I borrowed was The Sun Also Rises for absolutely no reason, except it was a little paperback, and it showed this intriguing picture of a matador and a ring of the bull ring. And that was something I never had seen or heard of before. So I thought, well, maybe this is something I should read. And when I started with my questions to Hemingway, the main question was, Mr. Hemingway, why have you come back to Spain for the first time since the Spanish Civil War? You swore you would never return to Spain while Franco was in power. He's still in power. And why are you here? And he looked at me and, not annoyed, but sort of quizzically, he said, well, I was here in 54 and 53 and 54 on my way to and from Africa. And I was here in 1956, and now it's 1959, and I'm here again. And he waited to hear what my response to that was, because when I had looked at my list, and I already knew that every question I had pertained to Franco and his not returning to Spain until Franco was dead or out of power. I had to think very fast on my feet, and I started telling him about Ireland, telling him about writers I knew, and about his banned book, Fiesta, which was the English edition of The Sun Also Rises, which I had found on the banned bookshelf and borrowed,
Did
which, of course,
he get a kick out of that story?
oh, he absolutely did. And that's what saved me, because if I had some boring thing or nothing to say, or to say, well, I really don't have any other questions because that's what the interview is about. Then he would have dismissed me, and that would have been the end of that. But then we had a lively conversation about Ireland and banned books, and then it turned out that one of my heroes was James Joyce, and I had already read Ulysses, which he was instrumental in having published. And it was published, it was the bookstore owner, the Shakespeare and Company
Oh, Sylvia
owner,
Beach.
Sylvia Beach, who had known Joyce, who'd come in, used to borrow books from there. And he showed her his manuscript, and she felt she could get it published. And indeed she did. But she asked a couple of the writers who came in, including Hemingway. She introduced him to James Joyce, and they became fast friends. So I was, that really yanked old Hemingway up in my estimation. That if he was a friend of Joyce, then then definitely he was worth knowing. So, but we had some laughs, and it was just a 30-minute interview. And Mary, his wife, and his friend Juanito Quintana, who came in because he had arranged. Hemingway was very methodical about his life and his work. And when he had a 30-minute interview, he always had an exit strategy. So at 29 minutes or thereabouts, Mary and Juanito arrived in the door and said, now it's time for the next activity. And just about that time, Hemingway was saying to me, "Well, what are you doing? What are you doing besides these English language interviews? And where have you been in Spain?" And he told me, "Well," I said, "I've just been taking day trips from Madrid. I didn't have much money, and I really wasn't. I for me, the adventure was just being in Madrid, which was, you know, five or six times as big as Dublin and more interesting, different language and so on. That was enough for me at that time." But he said, "You know, you must, if you're in a country, forget about where you've come from and travel around and learn about the history and culture of the country and, you know, take everything you can away from it." And then he said, "Are you going up to Pamplona for the fiesta in July, which was 2 months on?" And well, I said, "No, you know, I hadn't planned on that." And he said, "Well, you must do that. You can't spend a year in Spain," which was the amount of time I had put aside to go to Spain. And he said, "You can't spend a year here and not, you know, see something as important to Spanish culture as the feria at San Fermín." And then he said, "Well, it's already too late for you to get accommodation and bullfight tickets, but we'll get them for you." And I mean, I was just astounded. I mean, the whole thing was just such a, you know, it was an incident in my life that I couldn't have imagined, you know, if
You wind up with
or
Ernest.
wished for even.
Yeah, you wind up with Ernest Hemingway as the best tour guide ever to go to San Fermín. I mean, who could you ask
I
for?
was really lucky, both in Spain and France, and later in took me around New York and Key West, and of course the months in Cuba where I learned a great deal about that country, apart from the literature and learning to shoot, learning to fish on the Pila in the Gulf Stream. I mean, learning things that I had never even imagined in my life. And if somebody had said, "Do you want to do this?" I would say, "Of course not." But with Hemingway, there wasn't a no element to it. If you were with him, it was always a positive experience. So whenever he said, "Let's do something," you immediately hopped to and off you went and engaged in whatever it was. And it really promised to be fun. I mean, there was no day that I was with him that I said, "Oh gosh, this is boring. Gosh, what am I doing here when I could be somewhere else?" That just didn't even come into my mind.
And so you wind up in Pamplona, and then you wind up, that, what an experience this is, but this just keeps continuing because you become his assistant or private secretary, is that correct?
That's right, because in Pamplona we were there a few days, and he the next week, a week from the end of the Pamplona festival, on the which ended the 14th of July, on the 21st, Mary had planned a wonderful birthday, 60th birthday party for him in Malaga, and also the lead torero, bullfighter, Antonio Ordóñez, his wife had the same birthday, and she was 30. Well, she was 30 and he was 60, and this party was celebrating the double birthday. And Ernest had said to the people around the table that his little group that he called his cuadrilla, which is what the bullfighters, his entourage, his paid people who help his salt handler, the people who work in the bull ring with him, so we were Ernest's, we were his entourage, his cuadrilla, and he said to those, and two or three people had joined, or more. I mean, there were about eight of us all together, with varying. Everyone had pretty much some relationship to Ernest. To a couple of people my age, who were children of Hemingway's contemporaries, his friends, and they were graduating from college. We had about four college graduates. There were two girls and two boys in among the group, and they were around 21, 22 years old. So Ernest said to everyone, "You know, come down to the birthday party." Well, I knew, since these were all his friends and I was just a sort of person who was tagged on, I didn't answer. Some of them said, "Yes, we can go." Others said, "Well, we've other, you know, we've other plans." But then he said to me, well, will you come to the birthday party? And I said, well, no, I've got to go back and work in Madrid. You know, I mean, I said, I just, my life isn't one long holiday. And so that was all right. But the next day he said to his host, Bill Davis, his host down in the villa in Malaga, where the party was going to be, he said, Bill, don't you think our quadrilla needs a secretary? And Bill always said yes whenever Ernest asked him anything. So he said, well, what about making Miss Val our secretary? And then he turned to me and said, what do you think? Would you do that? He said, and he'd obviously thought about it, because he said, I can give you $250 a month, which was like, I was getting maybe, I don't think even $10 for each of the of the interviews. I mean, $250 a month was an immense amount of money. Well, I had to translate it from, I was in Spain, it was pesetas, in Ireland, it was pounds, Irish pounds. And I had to translate that, because I was still thinking in Irish pounds. And it just, and then I had a vague idea of what a dollar was against an Irish pound. But that didn't make me change my mind, because I said, well, I've got to think about it. Like, this seemed like an enormous thing. I would think about the different obligations I had down in Madrid. So anyway, when I thought about it, I thought, well, it'd be crazy not to do this, because he said, well, it would be for 2 months during the bullfight season, and he said you'll learn a lot more about journalism traveling with us than you will sitting in Madrid doing these interviews. So that sort of cinched it for me, because my goal was to get on in the journalism world, and especially to go back to Ireland, to the Irish Times, which wasn't able to hire me before I left, but had hinted that they would take me on staff if I made some progress, or special progress in Spain. So that seemed to me, wow, at the end, in another 2 months, I don't even have to stay till the end of the year. I can go back to Ireland with a triumph. But anyway, that's not how it happened. It the bullfighting season really didn't end till October. And we went up to France. We went up to France twice between September and October. And it was in October or early November when, before Ernest left, he asked me, it was October, and I remember now that he asked me if I would go to Cuba in January. And I was astounded, because, you know, I had never, you know, we'd never even suggested that this was going to be a long-term thing. But then again, I use the same reasoning, that, you know, how stupid it would be to not accept a trip to Cuba and to live with the Hemingways for several months and work for him. I mean, that was, when I mentioned it to a couple of my friends back in Madrid, they said, you'd be out of your head to refuse such a job.
Can you imagine how many journalists in your position would have been dying for this kind of an opportunity, you know? But you still wanted to think about it and make sure it was the right decision long term. I get starstruck sometimes. I would have been. But Hemingway wasn't that big of an idol to you at this point, right? He wasn't one of your favorite writers.
Because in Ireland, he was. You know, I was very interested in literature. In Ireland, we looked to England, to the masters of. Well, we had our own, you know, people like George Bernard Shaw and that. But the English Dickens. I mean, we were very much Anglo readers, and Americans didn't. Didn't feature in it at all. In fact, there was a sort of general feeling that, well, America was only in existence, you know, a couple of hundred years or so, and, you know, what could you learn to write in that, you know, compared to the couple of thousand or more years that they'd been writing English, and the Irish had been writing in English too, you know. So it was sort of a bit of a joke, really, that was before. I think there was a great resurgence or emergence of leading writers in America in the 20th century. I mean, the 19th century didn't really, that I know of, come out. The one author, American author that we studied in school was Hiawatha, Longfellow's Hiawatha. That was our entire introduction to American literature. So, but I think things changed. We all know things changed tremendously after that, and Hemingway was part of it. But what the Americans were writing just didn't seem to fall into the, certainly for the schools in Ireland, they weren't chosen as models of how one should write literature.
And, you know, even like you had mentioned too, that, you know, Hemingway wasn't really that big of a celebrity to you. And you did have some personal heroes or idols, and you told a story. Every time you tell the story, there's more that comes out about it. The Orson Welles story always gets everybody. And I was going to bring a guitar today to make you sing. I was going to get you to sing because of you added that last part of the anecdote last time. So, but would you mind telling that story? That's a classic one.
Yes. Well, I would love to have met Orson Welles, but that was in the capacity of drama, because Welles was well known in Ireland, and he had studied theatre with Micheál MacLiomore and Hilton Edwards, who founded the Gate Theatre. And that was a place, the Gate and the Gaiety and the Abbey Theatre were places where my brother and I, anytime we could scrounge together a few pennies or even shillings, we would go and see a play in Dublin. That was the epitome of our of our excitement in youth. And Orson Welles had been in Dublin, and he was staying actually about a mile and a half from the house where I grew up. I was at a boarding school, but in the summertime I spent my time at the family little hotel belonging to cousins. And when we learned that Orson Welles was just down the road at Sir Grattan Bellew, one day I picked up some tulips. Actually, I took them out of the vase on the table and walked down and to the gatekeeper and said, you know, could I see Mr. Welles? And he told me he's not there. Then I went on and actually brought the tulips to some friends, a friend's house who said, come and stay for dinner. And they put the tulips in a lovely vase. And as we were having dinner, the leaves the tulip leaves fell all down all over the table. So it's just as well
that would not have been
encounter with Welles. So that was only a few months before, you know, when I met Hemingway, and we went. Hemingway was actually the name Welles didn't come up, because at that point they didn't have good feeling between them. Welles had been picked to narrate the Spanish War. This is going back to the 1930s.
Yeah, the Spanish Earth. The film.
And Hemingway thought he was his voice didn't suit. It was too upper class. Since the Spanish War, the side that Hemingway was backing at the time, were the ordinary people, were not the Franco types. He was so Welles, his grand diction didn't fit in, and in the end, actually Hemingway, it's the only thing he narrated it himself. It's the only time we have him on tape except his speech for the Nobel Prize. But as we went through, we came to September and October, I think it was in late September, we were going up to Paris. And on the way, it was just at this time, Mary had taken the train with Bill Davis's wife, Annie. And so Bill and Ernest and I were going up to Paris from Nîmes. And on the way, Bill said there was a wonderful restaurant, and he said, you know, we'll have lunch there. He said, I'm pretty sure we'll be able to get in. We won't make a reservation. And Ernest didn't like, he liked to go places, but he didn't like to announce he was going there so that, he could go if he could incognito. So, but when the three of us arrived at the at it was a hotel that had this wonderful restaurant, and it was outside of Paris, you know, about 50 miles. The maitre d' met us and said, "Ah, bienvenue, Monsieur Wells."
Oh.
And Ernest, I mean, he just sort of drew his head up and sort of scowled and said, "Hemingway is the name." And the poor maitre d' was completely confused what had happened. But anyway, we were brought in, and there was one little table as you came in that was it was just a little round table set up for one person, and we were put on a slightly more a platform up, but we were on line with that table where you could see, we could both see the person coming in the door and see that table particularly. And as Orson Welles came in, I mean, Ernest was really still fuming. How could he be mistaken for Orson Welles, whom he thought was quite inferior to himself, which, you know, may or may not have been the case. But anyway, so Welles had his, he was sitting there, and I was thinking, oh gosh, I've never been so close to him, and this is my opportunity of meeting him. And so I was trying to think what I could say that would that might make this happen. And so it's when we were getting towards the end of our main meal, I said, "Oh, you know, I always wanted to meet Wells. I saw him in whatever, I'd seen him on the stage, and I just, you know, he's someone I really admire as an actor." And Hemingway said, "Well, I can easily arrange that." And he always had a little piece of paper and a pencil in his pocket, and he took out his notebook and wrote down a quick little note and handed it to the waiter. And it apparently asked Wells to join us for brandy and coffee after he'd finished his meal. He was sitting there. He had his what we called serviette, his napkin tied around his neck, and he was eating a full young pullet, a full chicken. I mean, he was in, and he didn't want to, apparently when he ate there, or when he ate, you know, a fine meal, he never wanted to be approached, or, you know, he wanted to have full attention. And the waiters were very careful to not allow anyone come to the table. So anyway, he did join us, and we had the jolliest time. And they ended up, Ernest and Orson ended up, you know, being all good fellows. And, you know, and he promised to meet us in Paris. And we did have a lovely lunch in Paris a few days later. And Mary was thrilled too, because I think she had a fondness for Orson. But she really embarrassed me by, we all used to sing. And Mary and Ernest had really, well, Mary had a beautiful voice, and Ernest had a reasonable voice. He certainly sang in tune. And they loved to harmonize. And when they were happy together, they would harmonize, often at the end of a meal. And but Mary embarrassed me, because my voice is rather mediocre, but I did learn to, you know, one learned singing at school, so it wasn't disastrous. But she had me sing in Irish for Orson. And I knew in the Hemingway, when you're traveling with the Hemingways, if you're asked to do something, you're expected to do it. You don't say, "Oh no, I can't do that. Oh no, I'm not good at that." That would have you thrown out. So I knew when Mary pressed me that I absolutely was required to do this. So I'm afraid that all the goodwill that I'd got with Orson when we met him at the cafe of the restaurant and had the lunch, that when he heard me singing, it was like, I could just see his face saying, "Oh God, why do I have to listen to this?" So that the friendship I hoped that would blossom there did not blossom.
But you reconciled, you facilitated the reconciliation between Wells and Hemingway, which had been decades of that ongoing feud.
Yes, that worked very nicely. And, you know, because sometimes people have, you know, you've had a bad experience, and then you just hold on to that sort of grudge. The Irish are great for begrudging. Begrudging is a word you hear every day in Ireland. I won't begrudge you, or I do begrudge you, or, you know. So when they got together that time, it was just pure fun. Yeah. So we bought him. Ernest started a little. He was sort of like a kid a lot of the time, and he decided he'd start some little society. He was a little club, and everybody had to have Swiss Army knives. And so when we got to Paris, a whole number of Swiss Army knives were bought, and they were handed out to the people in this little club. And Orson was presented with one when he came to lunch as part of that club. So.
So there's the Orson Welles.
Those were the antics that we had. There was always something. I mean, never. It was never just dull. It was never, oh dear, what are we going to do today? It was like, the day is not long enough.
As happens so often when I'm doing presentations on Hemingway, I always have to remind the audience, it's tough fitting Hem's life into a 20-minute forum, and I would say the same about Valerie's life. Valerie, can we invite you back to continue this conversation on an additional episode?
Yes, absolutely.
Fantastic. I'm Christopher Struble, inviting you to join us next time as we continue our cross-country lakeside chat with Valerie Hemingway, author of Running with the Bulls, My Time with the Hemingway Family.